We have Cass County, Cass City, Cassopolis, Cass Tech High School in Detroit, Cass Lake, and many other cities, townships, and streets, not only in Michigan but around the country, all named after Lewis Cass. He was a towering figure in Michigan and indeed the United States in the 19th century. So why is it we don't know very much about Lewis Cass? Historian Bill Loomis is here to set us straight. Bill, we know the name. Why don't we know the man and what he did?
You know, that's a good question. It's something that I was interested in myself. But there's a few reasons that historians have given as to why he's kind of gone by the wayside. I would say most importantly is he was a moderate person prior to the Civil War. His writing was not as fiery as a lot of other people, so he isn't quoted very often. I found only one quote attributed to Lewis Cass online. He was also temperate. He didn't drink, and so he wasn't a real sociable type of person or as sociable as others. But mostly, like I said, he was a moderate. He was in the middle. He saw himself as a national person, so he was always seeking support of the South and the North, which put him in kind of an empty spot in between.
Because there was not a lot of in between in that time leading up to the Civil War. You were either really anti-slavery or you wanted to preserve slavery.
Exactly.
But the contributions this man made are stunning when you run through them. Let's first talk about what Lewis Cass did for Michigan.
He was appointed by Madison as governor of Michigan in about 1814. It was in terrible shape after the War of 1812. People literally were starving. It was a lot of Indian, Native American attacks on farmers and things like that. So he had his hands full. In fact, he didn't even bring his family to Detroit for several years until he got things straight. It was a very terrible time.
Wow. So governor for 18 years.
That's right. He was governor for 18 years. He explored the North and became an expert on North American Indians in what was then the Northwest Territory. Mm-hmm. He was also he set down the laws in something called the Cass Code. He was very keen on having roads because during the War of 1812, one of the problems was there were no roads and they couldn't get supplies. So he established, say, like Michigan Avenue, the road to Chicago, if you will. He was just an all-around – he also had the biggest personal library. He was a scholar of sorts and had a formal education. So he had the biggest Michigan library at that time.
He also wrote our state motto, you tell us.
That's right. He wrote the state motto and designed the state seal.
But – and then as if that's not enough, what he did for the United States, his list of accomplishments and titles is mind-boggling.
Yeah. He served under, I think, five presidents. First assignment was from Thomas Jefferson in Ohio, and he went all the way through James Buchanan right before the Civil War. So he started – his real contributions began with Andrew Jackson as Secretary of War.
Secretary of War, Secretary of State, U.S. Senator, Brigadier General, Minister to France, Head of Indian Affairs, a friend to the King of France, and a presidential candidate.
Yeah, that's right, 1848. He lost to Zachary Taylor.
Why? But,
well, he was in between again. Yeah. It was this uncertainty. There were also three candidates. Martin Van Buren also ran as a Free Soil candidate, which sort of split the Democratic vote up. But he was, again, not a very good campaigner. He was kind of dull and didn't have the – Zachary Taylor at the time was a bit of a war hero from the Mexican-American War.
That's right. So that helped much the way we saw Eisenhower elected after World War II.
Exactly.
Tide of popular opinion and gratitude.
That's right.
But when you talk about Indian affairs, because that was part of what he was involved with, what positions did he take on that? Because my understanding from what you wrote is, was he actually part of the Trail of Tears?
Yeah, he kind of was. But as he saw it, his experience with Indians in the Northwest Territory was they were damaged in their relationship with white settlers.
Okay.
They were taken advantage of. Land was stolen from them. They suffered from terrible, terrible alcoholism, poverty. They were just victimized. And Georgia was growing. People were settling in there at a huge rate. In fact, the whole East was being settled, and they were just being pushed out. So as he saw it, it was not a great choice, but he saw it as the only hope for a lot of those tribes was to have them out west where they would not be near white people and be pushed to despair. He also, though, felt that he was what they called a spread eagle expansionist. He believed in complete expansion, physical, geographic expansion of the U.S. So he saw this as a manifest destiny. This was America's purpose.
And it was that mindset that led to incredibly horrific conditions for the native tribes.
Yes.
All the way through, across from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Yeah, but he did guarantee – well, I mean, it was a terrible thing. There's no there's no getting around it.
Yeah.
Cass did guarantee them safe passage. They had to walk, so people died of exposure and exhaustion. But he would not allow people to take advantage of them as they walked. He wouldn't allow them. He gave them protection as they went out west. He did a little better than some of that time. It was he was a man of his time.
A man of his time. And, and we're looking at him now with the hindsight from 2014. His positions on slavery, you write that he would actually weep when he thought about the United States breaking apart.
Yeah, his position on slavery was, again, like you say, he was a man of his time. But he was what was called a doughface. He was one of the a northerner with sympathies for the South. He didn't approve slavery, but he said it's there. We have to deal with it. He said this generation didn't start the slavery, so we have to treat it, you know. He did not like the abolitionists. On the other hand, he did not like the radical Southerners as well. So he was really trying to make both parties come together, and it just wasn't working.
And then you write that really his nightmare became the formation of the Republican Party, which you remind us happened in Jackson, Michigan.
That's right. That's right.
So that was what went into that? You had a meeting of, what, former Democrats, Whigs, and Free Soilers?
That's right. All the people that – the Whigs had basically disbanded. They were no longer around. And so they were looking for some place to go. A lot of his friends actually who were Democrats – went over to the Republican Party. And then the Free Soilers, of course, that was another party that was comprised of people who believed the new territories were to be free. So the Republicans were one step closer to the abolition of slavery.
And he wanted to let the territories decide as they entered, right? He was
That was something that he really took credit for, although other people had talked about it. But the idea of popular sovereignty, where the territory, let's say Kansas, Missouri, would decide themselves. The problem was people twisted it and started sending abolitionists, started sending in people by the hundreds, armed with guns. The Southerners came up, the same thing. They just contorted it until finally it was just a bloodbath and a kind of a precursor of the Civil War, really.
How was Lewis Cass then regarded during all of this? Was he demonized? Was he ignored?
Right. Up until, say, the mid-1840s, he was okay. But as it got closer in time, and I mean, people were pulling guns on each other on the floor of the Senate. So in that atmosphere, he was definitely demonized. He was, like I said, seen as a doughface. Walt Whitman wrote sarcastic poetry about him.
Whitman is throwing shade at you, that's not good.
I know. And up until then, Cass had been seen as sort of a modest kind of middle-of-the-road person, products of moderation. So when the 1850s hit, then feelings were just too distant. Nobody would come and sit at the table to work these things out. They really didn't want to.
So as the nation endured the Civil War, was he part of it? Was he on the sidelines back here in Michigan? And what happened for him after the war?
Well, he resigned under James Buchanan's presidency because Buchanan hesitated or refused to support the military, the U.S. military in South Carolina. Once he did that, then suddenly the northern viewpoint was very sympathetic for him and saw him as really not a bad person any longer. So he spent the Civil War in Detroit. He was quite old then. He was in his 80s. And he died actually a year after the surrender of the South occurred. But he retired and lived with his daughter. And they would go to Mackinac Island and relax and things like that. So he was in Detroit.
So it certainly seems that Lewis Cass deserves to be a little better remembered than he is.
I think so.
Bill Loomis, his story on Lewis Cass, the titan of Michigan's early years. You can find it on the Detroit News Michigan History blog site. Bill, thanks so much.
Oh, you bet, Cindy.